Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. We live in a radiation world. From microwaves to smoke detectors, from x-rays to nuclear power plants, this is the age of radiation. Radiation causes cancer, and it cures cancer. We embrace it, and we freak out about it. Best-selling author Craig Nelson is out with a new book that traces the history of the atomic age from Einstein to Edward Teller and Enrico Fermi. It's called The Age of Radiance, the epic rise and dramatic fall of the atomic era. And it tells the story of how mankind unlocked the power of nuclear energy for better and for worse. Craig Nelson has worked at a zoo and in Hollywood. He was a vice president and executive editor of Harper & Row, Hyperion, and Random House. He's an Eagle Scout and at one time worked as a Fuller Brush Man. Craig Nelson joins us from NPR Studios in New York City. And Craig, so good to have you. Welcome.
Thank you so much, Steve.
Well, you say in here that it's time that we learn to live with what you call blessed cures, and you're talking about atomic energy. But at the same time, you know, you read your accounts in this book about the failed power plants, the meltdowns at Chernobyl and Fukushima, and you can't help but wonder why we're still messing around with this stuff. So I'm wondering, when it comes to atomic power, what should our mindsets be?
Well, right now we're caught in a very difficult situation where we all know that our reliance on petrochemicals, notably coal, is a very bad idea. But our renewables, such as solar and wind, are not technologically sophisticated enough. They haven't reached an efficiency of technology to replace the petrochemicals. And unfortunately, the way station is nuclear power, which does not produce the same kind of problems in greenhouse gases. And our fears about it are grossly overblown.
Well, I was going to say, there was this carrot that was always involved with nuclear energy, this notion that we could get cheap energy from it. But you argue that really the scenario that we should be terrified of it really hasn't played out. The scenario that it would be this form of abundant, cheap energy really hasn't played out. In fact, you say we've reached the end of the atomic era. Why is that?
Well, I really think that we're going to see nuclear power fade out because it's very expensive to build these plants. It's very expensive to run them. And when they fail, such as Chernobyl and Fukushima, it's very expensive to fix the mess. So, and this is stuck so often in people's minds that you need to have government intervention to make this happen now, and it's going to be politically unfeasible to do it. So that's why I think we're seeing the end of this era.
So ultimately what? It's been an era of mixed results when it comes to atomic energy?
Well, I think the best example for a story about atomic energy is actually Three Mile Island, which even though it had a half meltdown of its core, and even though it was very frightening what could have happened, nothing actually did happen. No one was infected by any kind of radiation at Three Mile Island. But that accident happened at the same time that the China Syndrome, the Jane Fonda movie, was playing in theaters.
Right. That's right.
So what I like to say is that Americans first learned about nuclear science from watching movies and pictures of the victims of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and they first learned what's going on in a nuclear power plant from Three Mile Island and the China Syndrome. So the government and industry has done such a poor job educating us on this. All they did was start off by telling us it was going to be so cheap, it would be too cheap to meter, you know, and of course that's not true. but they did such a poor job explaining how, in fact, the safety measures at Three Mile Island protected the people of Pennsylvania, that we now have this terrible attitude about all of this, and I think it's beyond cure at this point.
You know, your description in this book of what exactly happened at Chernobyl is something straight out of a science fiction film. What would happen if one of these things melted down and it got away from us? What would be the consequence, Craig?
Well, in the United States, we have containment domes, and in most countries, we have containment domes. And in fact, in the United States, all of our civil reactors are based on the same design that we use in our nuclear submarines to power nuclear submarines. And that power plant has not had a problem in all these decades it's been running. And even though there have been operator errors and near mishaps and all these other problems going on with nuclear power, nothing has really happened in the United States. The Soviets used a very different system, and they used a They did not have a containment dome. They used a concrete shield because they were using their reactors to both produce electricity and produce plutonium for atomic weapons. Hmm. And that's why that created a cloud of fallout 400 times the size of Hiroshima that covered all of Europe. That could not happen in the U.S.
And they were just testing that plant at that. They were running a test of one kind or another that triggered that whole thing. Boy, that was a mistake.
Yeah, it was really sad. It was a safety test, mm-hmm. that destroyed all of that territory. But even in that situation, let's let the listeners guess. The worst nuclear accident in world history sends a cloud of radioactive fallout the size of 400 Hiroshimas that covers everything from Russia to Scandinavia to it covers everything except the Iberian Peninsula, except Spain. It lasts for 2 weeks. How many people do you think would die, and how many would cause genetic mutations? What do you think would happen? Yeah. And the answer is only 75. Most of those people died at the power plant itself trying to put out the fire. A lot of them were firefighters. Some of them were utility employees. The other people who died were children of families who didn't evacuate the region, and they drank the milk of contaminated cows. And because they were growing children, the iodine in the radioactive soil that got into the cows affected their thyroids. And if they had been living under a normal system with reasonable health care, they wouldn't have even died from that. So I think the outcome is so much less dramatic than all of our imaginations and fears. And we've created this nuclear myth.
And today you say there's all kinds of wildlife around that former power plant, right? What's happening over there?
It's an astonishing story. Because people pulled out, all this wildlife came back in. And they're doing all these studies. It's like a giant open-air laboratory. And the studies are very interesting because they're sort of conflicting. So on the one hand, they found moose bones left over from a wolf meal. And the moose bones are wildly radioactive, like frighteningly radioactive, but they haven't found any decline in the moose population over time. And the same thing is true. They have barn swallows that have a higher rate of being albinos and having reduced brain size, but there isn't any problem with the overall population. And the one thing that's really strange that's going on there is that the radiation has killed off a lot of the bacteria that decomposes the forest debris. So the dead leaves and branches and undergrowth aren't being turned over into the bacteria as fast as normal.
We're visiting with Craig Nelson. He's the author of a new book, The Age of Radiance, The Epic Rise and Dramatic Fall of the Atomic Era. Let's talk about some definitions here, Craig. You know, we're talking about microwave ovens and atomic energy and all these kinds of things. What exactly is this radiation, and where is it, and how do you harness it?
Well, 5 years ago, before I started on this book, I thought radioactivity was very rare and very dangerous. And probably the most shocking thing I found out in researching it is that it's everywhere.
Yeah.
It's falling down at us from cosmic rays. It's coming up at us from uranium decaying in the bedrock. It's in our kitty litter and our granite and our microwave ovens and our smoke detectors. And it's just all over the place. So there's that. And then I found out that the source of all this is sort of very interesting. It's the fact that it's made from little chubby atoms. So all radioactive materials have these little morbidly obese atoms that are so fat that they're spewing out little pieces of themselves. They actually break the bonds of the laws of attraction that form all matter and spit out little pieces of themselves. They spit out two kinds of subatomic particles, and they spit out a stream of photons called gamma rays that are like super X-rays. And that's what radioactivity is. So you can think of these atoms as being like the Hollywood stars of the periodic table. They're unstable and bulimic.
Yeah, and there's all kinds of energy when these things get released. There's just all kinds of energy that comes out of them, right?
Well, one of my favorite stories in the book, one of the things I really like about writing history books is bringing back to life people who we've forgotten. And one of the great stories in it is about a woman named Lisa Meitner.
I was going to ask you about her. Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, she was driven out of history by the Nazis for being a Jew, and then she was driven out of it by the post-war Germans for being a woman.
Yes.
And what Lisa did was she barely escaped. She ran the biggest physics department, the most important physics department in Germany, after becoming the first female university professor in the history of Germany for 12 years. And then she was driven out for having a Jewish ancestry. And she ended up in Sweden working for a guy who didn't like her and she didn't like him. And she's 60 years old and it's Christmas and she feels all washed up. And she goes for a walk with her nephew, Otto Robert, who reappears in the book again and again and again. He's sort of like the Zelig of atomic history. Anyway, so Lisa is walking in the snow, and she's pondering this very strange problem that her colleagues back at Berlin are having. Every time they bombard uranium with neutrons, they get barium. And the reason this is strange is because normally when you artificially irradiate something, a process invented by Marie Curie's daughter, Irene, I might add. But anyway, every time you artificially irradiate something, you move it a little bit on the periodic table. Primarily, you create isotopes of that thing. So there are little variations of it sitting mm-hmm. right next to it on the periodic table. But barium is way down the table from uranium. And it's so strange a thing to happen that the chemists back in Berlin assumed that there was something wrong with their instruments or there was something wrong with their chemistry and something else had to be going on. So Lisa is feeling all washed up and she sits down on a snow-covered log in Sweden for Christmas and she takes out a piece of paper. And she thinks about Niels Bohr's idea of the atomic nucleus being like a water drop. And she thinks, what if you squeeze that drop until it split? What would happen? So she adds up all the uranium and she adds up all the numbers from the barium. And then she takes out a portion of it and applies Einstein's E equals MC2 and it all fits. And when Otto Robert, comes back to where he works, he asks a neighbor, what do they call it when bacteria splits? And the neighbor says, we call it fission. And that was the discovery of fission.
Ah, just like that.
Yeah, amazing, huh?
And this woman, she's been totally lost to history, at least, you know, in my world, Lise Meitner, right?
It's a dreadful story, but there's a fantastic little piece of revenge. In the post-war world, her colleague back in Germany, Hahn, discovered he received the Nobel Prize for discovering fission when she did it while he was being interned as an enemy alien since he was working on atomic weapons for Hitler. So he gets the Nobel Prize and she doesn't. But the physics community extracted a revenge. They put him and her name up for contention to be named for a new element. And she got the nod. So there's a Meitnerium element on the periodic table. Well, Otto Hahn can never be named for an element ever again because he's already been nominated.
Well, that's revenge for you. There you go.
Yeah.
Well, everything in this story begins with a guy named Wilhelm Röntgen in Germany and his discovery of rays that so mystified him, he could only name them X. This was back in 1895. How did Wilhelm Röntgen discover X-rays?
Well, I love this story so much because almost every big famous person in this book, when we meet them, they're little nobodies in the middle of nowhere, and they're mm-hmm. sort of washed up and desperate. And and here's a Röntgen is at that hotbed of science, the University of Würzburg, which is a beautiful Dark Ages town, and he's a he's 50 years old. He's 10 years younger than Lisa, which you had heard of, but he's 50 years old. And most physicists, you know, when you look at what age they are when they make their big breakthroughs, they're like in their 20s. So like the average age of everybody at Los Alamos was 28. So here he is, Röntgen, 50 years old at the University of Würzburg. He lives in an apartment upstairs from the lab. The lab looks like a little poor man's version of Frankenstein. It's filled with all these things that make sparks, but other than that, it's pretty dilapidated. And what he's doing is he's playing with a vacuum tube that has two little electric nodes at each end of it, and he's throwing a huge battery charge through this vacuum tube. And so he's doing this, and he's turning off all the lights to see what happens, and he sees that something is glowing on the other side of his lab. And he goes over, and he finds it's this thing called a Luxcrem, which is a thing that shows you, they didn't call it electron jet, but it shows you electron activity. And he didn't know what this was, what's going on. So he kept trying over and over again to see what was happening with this. And at one point, his hand fell between the tube and the screen, and he saw the bones in his hand. And he thought he was losing his mind. And he kept this a secret for weeks and weeks and weeks. And finally, his wife said, "What is going on down there? I'm getting frightened for you." And he takes her down, and he puts her hand on a photographic plate, and he shines the beam, and he shows her the picture. And she goes, "Oh, my God, I've seen my own death." And they wonder if they should even tell people about this. But it becomes a tremendous fad. And, of course, in some parts of the world, they call them Röntgen rays, but we still call them by the name he gave them, X-rays, the unknown.
And he called them X-rays just because he didn't know what the heck it was.
And he thought it was terror, and he thought it was frightening. I think there was an element of disturbing quality because, you know, when you call something muon, that's sort of cute, you know what I mean? So they come up with other cute names for things, you know. I mean, when they were trying to come up with a name for one element, that at one time they thought they were going to call it pandemonium, and then they ended up calling it plutonium. So there's that.
Well, and for a while, X-rays were just this huge novelty item among the public. I mean, what were some of the uses for it?
Well, I hope there's some baby boomers listening in who remember that when they went through to the shoe store, you used to put your feet in a box and they would X-ray your feet size your shoes perfectly. And children love putting their feet in the box. And I don't know why we don't have lots of people with foot cancer running around after all of that. But that was one thing. And then at almost every World's Fair they had for decades, you would have your bags X-rayed and get a souvenir picture, and people were using it a lot. But then someone came up with the idea that maybe these would be good for tumors. And he had a woman with inoperable breast cancer, and he applied the X-rays against her. And because radiation especially attacks fast-growing tissue, it's very useful for killing tumors. And he was successful. But at that point, they didn't know how to adjust the X-ray strength except by putting their hand in front of the beam and getting a sunburn. So we lost an awful lot of early X-ray pioneers to cancer because of that.
I was going to say, did Röntgen or anyone else for that matter have any sense of the damage that extended exposure could cause?
No. It took a long time for people to apply what was going on. You know, the early reports of Pierre Curie talking about how funny it was that his fingers were covered with these warty-like growths and wasn't that interesting. I mean, even when they started having their own terrible medical problems, they found it fascinating and sort of magical in a way, and it didn't really dawn on them until some time had passed. So now the city of Hamburg has a monument to the martyrs of nuclear science, and there's almost 400 names on that monument.
Well, Marie is such an interesting person to me because, you know, she's one of the very few women pursuing, you know, scientific careers back then. How did she manage to work around all this prejudice against women in science back in those days?
She was a super dynamo, that Marie Curie. I got to say, you know, for decades, we've had to read historic portraits of her and Pierre where they go, who is more important in discovering radium, Marie or Pierre Curie? Who is the more significant scientific mind? Now, before I explain this, let me back up and say, I like Pierre very much because he discovered piezoelectricity, which is one of my favorite personal forms of electricity, because it's when you take certain crystals and you squeeze them a certain way and you get a spark out of that. And that's almost as magical as, you know, the radioactive powers coming out of rocks themselves, which are somewhere between the living and the dead. You know, we measure radioactivity in half-life. So there's something sort of semi-organic going on with all this. Anyway, so when Marie and Pierre meet, she is a recent Polish immigrant who has learned enough French and gotten herself... she's come from a territory where it's illegal for women to be educated past the age of 14. Wow. She's won 2 advanced degrees at the Sorbonne, the University of Paris. She got a scholarship and paid it back. And now she's about to begin Big Science, the union of corporations, government, and science to create a whole new area of research. And Pierre's a 35-year-old man living at home with his parents. So that's how she did it.
Man. Well, you talk about both of them winning the Nobel Peace Prize. You also note that them winning was of mutual benefit to the Curies and Nobel. How so?
Well, the prize had just started, and because she was a woman and because they had this whole couple story of doing it all together, and there was this whole sort of romance about them that she helped create. So she made the prize significant. The prize made them famous, but they made the prize significant. So it was a mutual back-scratching operation.
Huh. Let's move to Meitner's calculation. Tell us what that was and how weird it was that so many other top scientists missed it, given how obvious the whole thing was.
Well, the issue at that time was that the chemistry had not caught up with the physics. So all these people were thinking that they were producing, they called transuranes, which are these isotopes that barely were alive for fractions of seconds, when in fact they were splitting uranium and producing barium. So they couldn't figure out what was going on. And, you know, when you think about it, it's very hard to imagine. Before it's discovered, it's hard to imagine an atom splitting in half all by just nudging it a little bit with the stream of neutrons that they're bombarding uranium with. It isn't like a huge force, it's like a nudge. So to think of that splitting an atom in half is hard to conceptualize, besides the fact that people at this time had various models of atoms they were working from. So, you know, there was the plum pudding model of the atom, which is sort of like a big gooey thing filled with little study things like raisins and nuts. And people didn't really accept Niels Bohr's water droplet model yet. And some people didn't expect the theory of atoms at all. So it was and of course, you can't see any of these things directly. You have to rely on your Geiger counters to know what's going on. So it's an amazing, fantastic story. And it's just filled with magic to me, When Marie Curie went into her lab in the morning before the sun came up, she would leave out all her radium so it would be glowing there like these little aquatic fireflies. But then someone noticed that when she put the radium away, the walls were still glowing.
Huh. You know, the atmosphere in Europe, I'm just speeding ahead here, the atmosphere in Europe at the time starts getting, very tense and very worrisome for all its top scientists. The subsequent exodus to America and to England reads like this who's who of world-renowned scientists, among them Enrico Fermi, the Hungarian Quartet, which included Leo Szilard. Who else came out of Hungary and who else came to this country?
Well, it's an incredible thing that really the entire reason that nuclear science advanced was because Hitler kicked everybody out of Germany.
Yes.
And they were all afraid he was going to get the atomic bomb. And that was really the whole reason it happened. The American scientists at this time were all working on radar, and they had invented a form of GPS at the time called the Loomis Radar Network, and they were all working on short-term and long-term radar. And they thought nuclear science was crazy. They thought it was, like cold fusion, like we think of cold fusion or other wacky disproved ideas. They didn't believe it at all. So really, every single person who worked on it were recent immigrants seeking refuge in America from Hitler. And my favorite group of them, after Lisa Meitner, we give her due, and Marie Curie, of course. But my favorite group is this Hollywood Quartet. And the quartet is comprised of this is a whole group of guys who grew up very close to each other, a couple of kilometers from each other, in Budapest. They all then got advanced education in Berlin. So first they flee anti-Semitism in Hungary. Then they flee anti-Semitism in Germany.
Wow.
And they end up here. One of them is Leo Szilard, who co-invents the atomic reactor. One of them is Johnny von Neumann, who co-invents the personal computer. His wife, Clara, did the programming. And one of them is Edward Teller, who co-invents the hydrogen or fusion bomb. And the fourth is Eugene Wigner, who's the patron saint of Oak Ridge, Tennessee, for his creation of fissile fuel. And one of them said that, you know, we should really include a fifth person, Zsa Zsa Gabor, because we're all sort of like Martians, and she's a Hungarian Martian like us. And so they considered themselves the Martians of Hungary.
Oh, that's really funny. Let's do this. Let's take a break, Craig. When we come back, let's turn to the Manhattan Project. I want to ask you why Albert Einstein wasn't included on the list of scientists involved in that project. We'll get your questions, too, 816-235-2888. Again, 816-235-2888, or drop us an email to updatedate@kcur.org. We're visiting with Craig Nelson. The Age of Radiance is his new book, the subtitle, The Epic Rise and Dramatic Fall of the Atomic Era. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. Welcome back to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. If you missed our conversation with the infamous U2 incident, our visit with Senator Claire McCaskill, or the latest 90-mile view, you can find those at kcur.org. Tomorrow on the program, do your laundry or you'll die alone. That's the advice of one local author. We'll talk with her about life lessons, and we'll get this week's local listen. And some breaking news this hour, the Reverend Fred Phelps Sr., whose tiny Westboro Baptist Church has protested outside the funerals of fallen soldiers and celebrities to spread its views about homosexuality and abortion, has died. According to news reports, he was 84 years old. Again, Fred Phelps Sr. has passed. Lots of mixed reactions around this part of the country to this news. Again, the passing of the Reverend Fred Phelps. This hour, we're visiting with the Age of Radiance, the author Craig Nelson, about the history of the atomic era. You know, Craig, you know, we're talking about the Manhattan Project before we went on break, and so many famous scientists working on that project. One who didn't was Albert Einstein. Why not?
Well, my favorite story about the Manhattan Project is that we're educated so that we think that Albert Einstein and Robert Oppenheimer wrote equations on the chalkboard and voila, the bomb, you know, yeah. It just appeared out of nowhere. And in fact, frequently, Einstein's E equals MC2 is plastered against a picture of a bomb, a mushroom cloud, which would have driven him crazy. He was a great pacifist, and he started the whole thing, though, because Leo Szilard, one of the people, Hungarians we were talking about earlier, convinced Einstein to write a letter to FDR saying that Hitler might get the bomb and we better do something, and that's how the Manhattan Project started. But afterwards, he told Szilard that, you know, if he had known that the Nazis were never going to have the bomb, he wouldn't have lifted a finger, because he was a great pacifist. And he also had a lot of communist friends, so this made the army security people at Los Alamos not want him around. But they did, in fact, bring him around a couple of times to consult, but he was recognized on the streets of the city, so they stopped that, too.
There were so many mixed feelings by some of these scientists about the work they were doing. They knew about the potential destructive power they were potentially unleashing on the world. And yet, as you just mentioned, there was this fear of Hitler. How did those competing ideas, competing emotions affect these guys?
Well, they were speeding ahead full blast because Germany was still considered the center of science, and they assumed that the Germans were ahead of them. And so they were still moving forward as fast as they possibly could. And I have a heartbreaking line from one of them that says, "We knew that if we lost the war, it would all be because of our own fault and not doing our jobs." And they really thought that everything depended on them. But at the same time, they knew exactly that there was tremendous power for ill to come out of this. And they knew that, you know, even after, if someone figured out the bomb after they invented it, ill could come that way. So all of these ideas were going around from the very dawn of the project.
You know, there's this misconception out there, Craig, that, you know, everything happened at Los Alamos down in New Mexico, when in fact one of the first major breakthroughs actually occurred in Chicago. Tell us what happened on an abandoned squash court in Chicago.
Well, this is a marvelous story. The president of the University of Chicago decided that football had no place being in university at an Ivy League school, so he stopped the football team. But he didn't tear down their Gothic cathedral-type football stadium in the middle of campus, and it was falling to pieces. And the Manhattan Project was just starting up, and somebody had to build the first nuclear reactor. And there was a strike on with the workers constructing the building that was supposed to be where it was supposed to go in the Argonne Forest. So Enrico Fermi decided he would build it in the squash court of this abandoned football stadium. And beginning November 16th, 1942, he put together 46 tons of uranium and 380 tons of graphite in this oval-shaped lattice array inside the squash court, and they went and got the Goodyear company to make a giant square balloon to cover it in case they needed to do it in a vacuum, but that ended up not being necessary. And I think it's one of those frightening experiments in the history of science, because you're setting off the first nuclear reactor in the middle of Chicago. But Fermi was incredibly meticulous, and the experiment was flawless, and that was the birth of the atomic age.
Oh, that's interesting. The story of the Manhattan Project wouldn't be complete without writing about Robert Oppenheimer. How good a scientist was he?
Well, Oppenheimer, when Groves came out west to decide
Leslie who should... Leslie Groves, you're talking about.
Yeah, Leslie Groves came out west to decide who should head up the Manhattan Project. He wanted... another guy to do it, and that guy said no.
Oppenheimer said yes.
Excuse me, the inventor of the cyclotron, whose name will pop back in my head in a moment. But anyway, but Oppenheimer realized at his age that he was never going to be one of the great geniuses of his era, even though he did help discover the origins of black holes, and he just didn't pursue it. So he decided that he should be a handmaid to genius. And his great passion was physics and New Mexico, and he wanted to figure out how to combine them. So he took Groves to this isolated little spot in New Mexico, which had one telephone cable and one road going in and out. And Groves was the most security-conscious man in the Army, and he said, great, let's do it. So that was the birth of Los Alamos.
You know, after overseeing this project, that brought about the end of the war, and then he continued to serve his country as part of the Atomic Energy Commission, he ended up as a victim of professional, resentment and rumors of his disloyalty. What was the eventual outcome of all that?
Well, he was a consultant to the AEC. And in fact, one of the most amazing things about this story is how these most Oppenheimer is the exception, but most of these immigrants who were kicked out of Europe and show up in America and barely have learned English and are these nerdy little guys doing experiments in labs become, handmaidens to power. They become consultants to the Oval Office, and they appear before Congress. And being a Los Alamos scientist was almost your passport to any door being open for you. So Oppenheimer is consulting for the Atomic Energy Commission, and he's really working hard with a number of other prominent American politicians in Washington to try and get arms control started, because they know the Soviet Union is going to have the bomb. They know that there's going to be this arms race. They know that all these things are going to happen. And they're trying to figure out how the United Nations can keep this from getting out of control. And he's regularly putting the brakes on Ed Teller's development of thermonuclear weapons. And the guy who Eisenhower picks to run the AEC, Strauss, becomes infuriated with this, and he starts seeing that Oppenheimer's great prestige is allowing him to spread this arms control idea everywhere. So he basically brings Oppenheimer up on charges of disloyalty to get his security clearance canceled. And his star witness is Ed Teller, who decides he has a grudge against Oppenheimer for not pursuing this research, and they get him kicked off the AEC.
I was going to say, Teller wanted a different kind of atomic weapon. What did he want to do, and why wasn't it pursued?
Well, Teller went to lunch with his great mentor, Fermi. Mm-hmm. And Fermi said, you know, I don't know why we're working on fission bombs, because fission is going to create such heat that it's going to create fusion. And you could make a 3 times bigger bomb at half the cost if you just went directly to fusion bombs. And this made Teller sort of crazy that everybody was working on the wrong thing. And he was convinced he was going to work on the right thing, which was thermonuclear or hydrogen or fission fusion or super bombs. It was called by different names over the course of its history. And just as Szilard was fearful that Hitler was going to get the atomic bomb, Teller was afraid that Stalin was going to get the thermonuclear bomb. So he was rushing headlong forward to get that taken care of, too.
816-235-2888 is our phone number here. We're talking about the history of the atomic era. Our guest, Craig Nelson, his new book, The Age of Radiance. Again, 816-235-2888. We had a call. We just lost it. It was from someone who was worried that her dishware might be radioactive. I know you talk about that in the book. What about that?
Well, there is a whole era of dishware from the 40s and 50s where they used uranium to bake in the color. Wow. And she probably should have that tested if she's worried about it, and she shouldn't be eating off of it.
Too much, eh? Just too much.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
Let's go into the Nevada desert on the morning in July of 1945 when the first atomic bomb is detonated, the first testing of that weapon occurs. You have an incredibly dramatic set of reactions to what people witnessed and saw that morning. What strikes you about that morning that stands out to you now, Craig?
Well, I guess what I like is, if you remember the movie Close Encounters of the Third Line, of the Third Kind, excuse me, and you remember those faces bathed in light as they're astonished by the arrival of the spaceship, that is exactly what happened with Trinity Test, the first atomic bomb explosion. No one had ever seen anything like it. It was just staggering. They couldn't take their eyes off it. It was beautiful. It was terrible. It was terrifying. It was frightening. It was awful. It was gorgeous. And they literally struggled to describe their experience. It's a great moment of science meeting poetry, I think.
I love this detail from the book. As the bomb was hoisted into position that morning up in the air by a $20,000 winch, everybody became nervous that the bomb's 5-ton weight would wind up snapping the cable supporting it. So they ended up piling a bunch of mattresses underneath it just in case the thing fell. I mean, what an image.
I love stories like that. Isn't it great?
Yeah.
You know, the first atomic bomb, and underneath it is this big pile of used mattresses. And underneath that was a big pile of linoleum. That's what the base of the base was, linoleum.
So were they Serta mattresses or were they something else?
Oh, no. These are used Army mattresses. They're probably from the Civil War, these mattresses.
Yeah. You know, Leo Szilard, you've already mentioned him. Maybe he had the greatest foresight as to what this moment was going to mean for the rest of humankind. What did he wind up foreseeing and who did he contact with all his concerns?
Well, the great thing that Szilard did was he wrote this collection of short stories that ended up being translated into Russian and getting into the Soviet Union. And one of them was about how a theoretical case of a physicist who works on nuclear weapons and who loses a war and gets tried for being a war criminal. Mm-hmm. And what happened was the nuclear scientists in Russia read this short story, and it completely turned their thinking around, and they decided to start becoming dissidents. And that's how Andrei Sakharov became a dissident, by reading the anti-nuclear short story of the guy who co-invented the nuclear reactor. So I hope everyone can keep that straight, but I think it's just incredible.
Yeah, yeah. Well, even as they glimpsed the potential destructive power, you know, of what these bombs could do, they sure didn't stop working on it. Part of that was due to the pressures of winning the war. How much of it was the scientists and them that they had to know how this thing was going to work and if their calculations were right to begin with?
Well, I'm convinced that, of course, you know, that's the whole fundamental reason you go into science.
Yes, absolutely.
Is to have your theories proven. So that's sort of like a bedrock in the DNA of these guys thing to find out. So there's so many conflicting emotions, and that's why I love this story, you know. It isn't just a happy little story with a happy little ending. It's everyone is conflicted. Everyone is controversial. Everyone has mixed feelings. I mean, there's so many fantastic ironies going on. Like, I know a lot of our listeners are very smart. So here's your brain puzzle for the day, okay?
Yeah, sure.
So Alfred Nobel's great dream was to create a weapon of such power that it would make war unfeasible. And Nobel's invention of dynamite, of TNT, that fortune is what funds the Nobel Peace Prize.
If that's really interesting.
You believe that the Cold War stayed cold because everybody had thermonuclear weapons, then shouldn't the guys who invented thermonuclear weapons and fulfilled Nobel's dream get the Nobel Peace Prize? I'm not saying they should, but a lot of people could follow that logic and it makes some kind of sense. One of my favorite scenes in the book is when Ronald Reagan goes to Margaret Thatcher and says, "I have a great dream of ending all nuclear weapons everywhere." And she goes, "Are you crazy? That's the only thing that's kept us from World War III."
Oh,
I just think it's a wonderful moment.
You'd like to have that on tape, wouldn't you? I mean, you know, one of the uglier aspects of all this testing was the use of human subjects, oftentimes without their knowledge or even their consent. Who were some of the people harmed in what ways as you look back on it, Craig?
Well, the Nevada test site, they just went crazy blowing things up over and over and over and over and over again. And I think, you know, you look at pictures and movies of atomic detonations, and they are gorgeous and terrifying in their own way. You know, the air is ionized. It glows purple. Someone says it looks like a diseased brain. So I can see why they would want to look at this over and over and over again. But it's really outrageous what happened, because we've now determined that the Cold War atomic tests in Nevada have contaminated the entire continent with airborne radioactive iodine, so that this year, 11,000 Americans will die from the effects of that pollution from all those years ago. So that's how contaminated it is. And the other terrible irony is that a couple of months after the bomb was dropped on Hiroshima, a typhoon attacked Hiroshima and devastated it and killed 5,000 people. But it washed away all the radiation from the atomic bomb. So now Hiroshima is in much better shape from nuclear pollution than Nevada.
Oh, boy. That's amazing. Well, Craig Nelson, again, he's the author of The Age of Radiance as the Epic Rise and Dramatic Fall of the Atomic Era. What an amazing story, Craig. And I'm sure glad you took some time to come in here and share it with us. We sure appreciate it.
It's been great, Steve. Thank you so much.
All the best, Craig. You bet.